Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Well, I am very privileged today to be joined again by Stephen J. Manning. And we are here to talk about AI and UBI and a future together. What the hell is UBI? It is Universal Basic Income. And actually, as AI grows and job disruption gets more rapid, so the skill gap is just not filled, we need Universal Basic Income, because without it, a lot of people are actually going to be much worse off. And there are many, many other benefits of that. And we're here to talk about that. We've been doing a lot of research. I've looked at McKinsey. I've looked at MIT. I've looked at all sorts of sources. And Stephen's been researching away as well. And we're here to really dig deep into this in the next half hour, maybe 40 minutes. And it's going to be a really interesting conversation. We're going to delve as deep as we can into this whilst retaining some sort of normal tech-free conversation, to be brutally honest. So, it's a real pleasure, Steve. Always great to see you, and looking forward to digging into this.
Likewise, and thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So, I mean, we have automation. We have job displacement. We have loads of small businesses and loads of ambitious professionals who want more out of life. They want a sense of freedom and they want a secure future. But the problem is that a lot of them are really scared about this and about losing their job to AI. And I'm a little bit worried for them, but I do think that universal basic income is a really great safety net, in my opinion, for this. What do you think? Do you think it's a safety net, or do you think it's kind of demotivational for people, or a necessity, or what are your thoughts on that, Steve?
Well, yes, and yes. Let me just offer this for a moment. I'm certainly not a social scientist. I may be perhaps an armchair macroeconomist. And when you talk about UBI, let me just, as an aside to this, I do profess some competency on spectacularly failed other systems, for example, the communist model, and the increasingly more struggling limited future of socialism. Those are all ultimately impact on people's ability to make a living, people existence. So when I think about UBI, basic terms come to mind: conformity, complacency, which is necessary to live in a system like that. That by definition requires obedience. You must obey the nanny state, if you will. And all of that to result in what is a basic existence, a baseline existence. For many people, that's a great way of life. I saw that firsthand in communist countries, socialist countries. And of course, being a capitalist and a Yankee, I reject that just as a basic construct. Now, the problem, of course, and I'm glad to speak on things like even minimum wage. If you think about UBI, UBI is here on a penthouse floor. Minimum wage is kind of a baseline idea. But there's a raging debate among smart top-line economists whether minimum wage is a good thing or minimum wage is a bad thing. There is always a conflict between guaranteeing a minimum wage or an income. And the economy at large. This is to a lot of smart people, minimum wage, and of course the ultimate, which is a guaranteed income, is multidimensionally deleterious to commerce, to the economy, to progress. So if you think about things like minimum wage, for example, the effects on prices, thus revenues, thus, the ability of businesses to maintain their workforce, much less increase the workforce. Particularly in vertical businesses, it's enormously challenging. You want a real-time example? Take a look at my state, California, the fifth largest economy in the world, by the way, that's reeling from an increase of minimum wage to fast food workers. There's 500,000 of those in California alone. It's now by law, X dollars. It's a couple dollars more than minimum wage. There are layoffs, there are massive hits to revenues. There are chains closing down. And one of the California dreaming favorites, In-N-Out Burgers, the first time in decades raised the prices consistently with the increase on that wage. Imagine if we scale all that down, we guarantee an income for everyone, and then what happens? All those people at that income level can no longer afford a burger. As it is, yeah. You can pay $25 for burger and fries and all that at a McDonald's in New York City. McDonald's is not happy with that. I have some insight in their statistics. It's kind of scary to see what happens to business that's truly universal when you start imposing income requirements for certain people. Now, I'm not the one to pontificate on stop minimum wage, because my altruistic side says people should be able to eat and drink and pay for clothes and raise their children. On the other hand, if you don't have a job, you can't do that anyway. So you raise those income levels higher, or just guarantee it. You don't have to go to work. What are you going to do? You're going to be complacency. You have to obey the system. You become a nanny state ward. You have a baseline existence. If that does not spell to stopping progress, I don't know what does. But this is a very, very big topic. You and I talked about it. You want to talk about workforce reskilling, reskilling. What do you do with millions of people that are out of work because the machines do it better? And I don't want to move back to something we did a week ago, which I thought was really relevant when we talked about what happens to singularity. Do machines really take over? Then we have to guarantee income because millions of people lose their jobs. Well, I continue to talk about the hierarchy of machines, hierarchy of people, how they peacefully coexist and go in future. But what happens as AI gallops ahead unimpeded? And now you have millions of people whose jobs are absolutely superfluous. What do you do with those people? Do you think you can reskill them contemporaneously? To do what? To do what? Well, to write code? No. However, I'm glad to get into it. I do have some thought on what I hope happens, and I can see happening, which would be a cataclysmic shift in where business is conducted in countries like America. I speak more authoritatively about U.S. than anywhere else, but I can see potential for AI to change the business paradigm where these people, we're not going to reskill people in AI concept. We can, in fact, allow people to learn, self-teach, make use of software to use AI differently than they ever conceived they might. And that might just change the entire business paradigm. A shift from big business to small business, cataclysmically so. Millions of people who are quality folks, because they are intrinsically education experience, they have to find something relevant to do. Yeah. And you know what? I can see myself running a shoe repair shop with two machines. If I can do that really well and make a very good living. I've run a $1 billion business and I've run a $3 million business that made $1 million a year. And I've run a big business that's eked out money. Fortunately for me, I've never experienced the downside of big business, but I certainly have clients, multi-billion-dollar businesses that lose multi-billion dollars. It's a funny thing. If you and I become unemployed entirely, you and I today, the next 12 months, we will make a lot more money than a significant percentage of the Fortune 100. They'll lose billions and billions. You and I will make nothing, unemployment money, but we're more successful. True.
True.
Okay. Anyway, I'll let you guide the conversation because
Steve, you said
a lot. I have strong feelings on this, but
you've just dug into literally so much stuff, and I've got some notes here which I'm kind of looking at, and I'm really don't know where to start. If I'm honest, I mean, I think let's start with what sort of things I see happening, and what MIT sees happening. And what I've learned from kind of understanding how the shifts in work is growing, right? So from what I can see, skilled workers are like, for example, people who work with their hands. So if you are a woodsman and you are a carpenter and you are people like this, and you have a service-based business, you are less likely, I think, in the short term to suffer from being out of work, right? In this respect, obviously that could change because we've seen how fast these things change. But what I've also seen is that new product development has actually sped up, right? But that's only sped up with people who know about data. So for example, the Climax Foods are doing something amazing with vegan cheese, okay, that's created using AI. I made a funny face when I read this too, right? But their CEO is ex-Google head of data science, Oliver Zahn, right? So they clearly have an idea about the data and what they're doing, okay? But it doesn't mean they're not going to use humans to manufacture cheese, right? It means the product of NPD, new product development, for anyone who doesn't know what NPD is, you probably do, is way faster, right? So I found that hugely interesting, hugely exciting. But then on the reverse of this, right, you've got this guy called Jonathan McIntyre, who's a food consultant, and he used to head R&D teams in beverages and snacks at PepsiCo. And he thinks the technology is significantly overhyped, is what he says, as a tool for his field. He says it's only as good as the data that you feed it, which is what you and I were talking about last week, the week before, and however many times we talked about this subject, right? And basically, he's saying there's not going to be enough data to yield productive results, which is interesting because he basically says during his stint at Pepsi, he attempted to use IBM's Watson to create a better soda. And he said it formulated the worst tasting soda ever, which I thought was quite interesting. But I have seen IBM Watson at Wimbledon, and I've had a conversation with the IBM Watson chatbot at Wimbledon in the basement of Wimbledon. And that was really interesting. And you, as a tennis expert, would absolutely love that chatbot. You would be chatting to this chatbot for hours about tennis, I'm sure. And IBM are doing some groundbreaking things with AI, as are lots and lots of these tech companies, but they don't want you to know what they're doing because then someone else is going to have the competitive advantage. And this is why they're keeping very quiet in this field. But what you said about communism, socialism, et cetera, I mean, I live in Croatia, so, this is Eastern Europe, right? So I spent some time in Poland. I've heard a lot of stories. And I understand a lot of people who live here are still in that mindset. It's 30-year-old country, so a 35-year-old country. So they're still in that mindset of how communism is, right? So,
well, I would like to make a comment on that, if you allow me,
please.
Because it's huge.
Please.
It's huge.
Yeah, it's massive. Yeah.
And I'll go backwards a little bit if you don't mind, but to re-educate generationally addicted people to systems is really complicated. Very briefly, when the Iron Curtain first came down, call it 1990, as you know, I created an industry in Central and Eastern Europe, several countries. Nobody had checking accounts. Nobody had credit cards. There were no checks. There are no social and economic structures to support a free economy. Hell, the free economy erupted on a Tuesday morning. Okay, go manage. My fondest story is that over the years, I might have had some issues taking money out of banks, But that's the first time I ever had an issue putting money in a bank. I mean, suitcases with Citibank traveler's checks. At 3 months of negotiations to open what? Accounts to put a lot of money into? At 4 hours sitting at a counter signing checks? How about I wire it? Oh, no, got to bring checks. The most difficult thing, ignoring the lack of systems, lack of governmental procedures. Heck, the government sued me on the basis of a 1907 law that nobody could find. Well, it turned out they invented it that morning, and they came after us for unfair advertising because we ran comparative ads. You can buy Nathaniel's thing for $90. You can buy our thing for $4, just as good. And I did something really stupid. I introduced 100% unconditional, no questions asked guarantee. Oh, boy. The world was going to collapse. Oh, by the way, fortunately, we provided goods that really stood up. We had absolutely negligible returns, but that's not the point. The point is, other than governmental interference, which stacks of $100 bills came in very handy, I don't mind sharing it, it's been years now. Other than that, the most challenging thing was to explain to the workforce that when I introduced incentive, the big American actually meant it. Are you kidding? If this is the task for the week, if you all finish this by midnight Sunday, you get X more per order that we process. And that will be wired to your account. Took me a year until they believed it, and only believed it when they hit the benchmarks 2 weeks in a row. And at 4 a.m, they call me in LA and say, I found $1,200 in my account in Austria. Where did that come from? You? Do you have a, can you multiply X of those times Y dollars? It's in dollars. Well, you meant it. Well, I meant it for last year. The point is, here's a working population that is used to a guaranteed income, guaranteed health care, food subsidies, guaranteed health care, which is, again, I mentioned that twice because that's huge, and including drugs, and a subsistence level of living, which, of course, spawns a black economy, the underground stuff, where, you know, the dentist never has a plumber's bill. The plumber never pays for dental work. Basically, the shoeshine guy, the plumber has fantastic shoes because shoeshine guy doesn't. But a shoeshine guy also gets free plumbing. Now, that may very well be something that we will experience in sophisticated economies like the United States, trade economies. By the way, it exists in good parts of Europe at a very interesting level. I'm familiar with the Scandinavian models and all that, but okay. I want to go back to something you said. Speaking of Oliver Zent and making cheese, I met this cheesemaker in a little store in a city called Courtmayeur. It's on the foot of Mont Blanc on the Italian side. It's one of the most spectacular places in the world. I skied Courtmayeur. More importantly, I used to walk into his cheese shop all the time and buy a lot of great cheese. He had 1,400 cheeses and all that stuff and would sit on the bench and eat. With all due respect to Mr. Zent, who is brilliant, I think I'm going to have Hans's cheese as long as his family makes it.
I'm not sure okay. I like vegan cheese either. Well, it's okay. I mean, I've had vegan cheese
don't
before,
even,
but it's not real cheese.
To my two vegan friends who cheat, knock yourself out. You know, the Pepsi guy, I don't want to get into that because I can write 4,000 words on that by nightfall. But it's the thing that I referenced a minute ago in terms of guaranteed universal income. To create a massive, look, AI has the potential of putting millions of people out of work. You and I talked about this at length a week ago, and I don't want to get into the hierarchies of machines, hierarchies of people, how that they coexist, and they push everything forward and hopefully throttle it as well, keep it relevant and not destructive. You know, every cataclysmic upheaval in tech, science, blah, blah, has the potential of being totally destructive. We can, in fact, blow ourselves up. We live in a world where two blonde, blue-eyed 24-year-olds from Kansas in an F-35 can't change the world. Let's be clear. Yeah, true. It's a fact of life. True. So the world is, well, it's what it is. But I said, we can't re-educate 7 million people in a matter of moments because AI is galloping at a rate that's just spellbinding. But so what happens then? Well, as you said, there already is a nascent but growing incredible industry of people going to tell us how to use AI. We can't make it, we can't change it, but we can learn how to use it. And then how to partake in the benefits of that. Okay, so is it possible that two things? One, there will be people like you and I and others who are far smarter than I am, far more forward-looking. The people on the top of the hierarchy of those folks that influence the growth and use of AI and all of that, and influence policy like minimum wage, guaranteed income, can hold that genie down or guide it long enough where a lot of us will figure out we can't all own a bed and breakfast in Connecticut. If you look at who owns bed and breakfast in Connecticut, you'll find there's a lot of those that are my great-grandfather owned it. And then you have a software engineer from Des Moines. And then you have
My great-grandfather had a vineyard in Connecticut.
Next door is a massive portfolio manager in New York who said, this is not a way to live. I haven't seen my kids in 4 years. Buys a bed and breakfast. We can't all do that. But we will all, many of us will sit around and say, what exactly am I going to do to feed myself and my family and all of that? You know, this is not meant to be a joke. But every one of us in LA who have some, if you will, wherewithal or success, at one point or twice or three times or 7,000 times, we said, this is just too darn complicated. My God, dealing with all the taxes, regulatory agencies, competition at every level. I don't want to talk to the Attorney General of the state of Missouri again. I didn't like it the last time. You know what? I would love to own a Tommy's Chili Burger stand. There's something called a Tommy's in L.A. It's an institution. You go there and there are lines all the time for what is an ordinary chili burger. In fact, half the people that they are lawyers from the courthouses downtown. If you come to L.A., you and I go to Tommy's for a chili burger. We all want to have a Tommy's because a line there 20 hours a day.
I mean, no, but it's when I come to L.A. again, yeah? But
when you come to L.A.
But we need to address. I've got to interrupt you.
But let me finish because there's a point there somewhere. There's a pony among all this horse rubbish. There's a pony somewhere. The pony is that we've all wanted to do that. And I'll tell you what else we've all wanted to do. Because you know what? Imagine just run a hamburger joint. Forget all this. And then you put a pencil to it and say, wait a minute now, that's not going to buy expensive cars. It's a good business. And then everyone of us wants to drive a big semi-truck. You know why? I am so frustrated business. I'm going to drive a semi-truck. Nobody's going to make a bad left turn in front of me. That said, when I don't have an option, I'm going to look around and say, what cottage business can I create and use AI? I don't know how to fix shoes, but AI does. I don't know how to read x-rays, but AI does. I'm picking two technically polar opposites. And I think that is a possibility in our future as AI takes over the world. No, it's not. That we will develop, we will have an incredible explosion of small business in America.
I agree.
Small
this
businesses
is exactly,
cooperatives of small businesses, and they'll shift revenues from big business to small business, which of course is temporary because in due time, big business will buy small business and then we go to the cycle again and again.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But
thanks
but
for indulging me with a little retrospective here.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You said some very interesting things there because according to what I was reading in one of these reports, I think it was McKinsey, that actually there are going to be a lot more gig economy workers, which is interesting.
Without a doubt.
Right? Which is what you've basically talked around it. You didn't mention the word gig, but really that's kind of there too. Small business and gig economy, very close together, right? But the thing is
glad to share the glory with McKinsey.
It's well, there you go. Great minds think alike, right? So when you look at all of this, with the elephant in the room that I was excited about mentioning a minute ago is who on earth is going to pay for universal basic income? And I think Europe is going to turn around and go, okay, so, you know, they already like to fine a lot of these big tech companies, right? But as the tech layoffs become more and more and more and profits become larger and larger, I personally believe that Europe will probably be the first place that says, do you know what? Actually, you're going to have to fund this because we're not funding it. And then they're going to stop fining these companies and they're going to work much closer with them. And they're going to say, well, okay, you've just got rid of 10,000 workers. Well, actually, that's going to fund 100,000 universal basic income requirements, right? And that's what I personally think is going to happen. I think it's very interesting because the way that this skills gap is going to work is that people can eventually upskill themselves. They're eventually going to be able to do something new, right? They will eventually. And this has happened throughout the history of time and disruption, right? I mean, you know, when you sort of go back in the day and you look at the amount of millions of people that have actually been displaced due to new jobs that have basically come into play. I was trying to find something that I wrote here on my four pages of notes and I can't find it. But basically since 2000, so many of these jobs that are in marketing, as one example, didn't even exist in 2000, let alone maybe not even 2015, right? If you actually look at it, or even 2020, some of these jobs. But in my personal opinion, I think we need to embrace this change in work. We need to actually embrace it. And we need to turn around and say, well, do you know what? I'm actually going to enjoy life a bit more than I was before. And, you know, I did an experiment. I didn't work for a number of months. I'm not going to say how many because it was kind of a bit greedy, really. But I didn't work for a number of months. When you first contacted me, I wasn't working because I decided I'm going to just take some time off. It was summer here. And I took some time off, and it took you a few months to convince me actually I did want to work and do some work with you. And actually, I got bored. And I believe from that experience, I actually think that even if the universal basic income gives people more money than they actually need, so they've got some disposable income to do some hobbies or whatever it is they want to do, I believe that they will actually get bored because being in a creative career or in a career is actually it's enjoyable. Like, I mean, you love what you do, right? I love what I do. Yeah, I love spending time talking to smart people like yourself and writing blogs and white papers and all this kind of stuff. But people, I think it's going to give them just a little break that they need. And actually, according to what I read here, what's very, very interesting is that actually it could be crucial. Universal basic income could become crucial for facilitating an exit option for spouses, right, in undesirable or abusive relationships as it balances the intra-household income. That's an interesting byproduct.
Well, I think it's an interesting byproduct, but it's not exactly quantitatively. Well, qualitatively is obviously a fantastic idea, but quantitatively, what percentage of households have abusive relationships where one spouse needs to find an exit valve, if you will. It exists, but I don't think that's an economy bending also, or altering thing.
I agree, but there's also another one. I've got another one here that I think is interesting. And actually, the mental health disorders are becoming very common, certainly in the Western world, I'm not just the US, and they affect millions of people and cost billions of dollars, right, per year. And whilst it wouldn't solve it immediately, right, it would actually improve mental health by reducing the financial insecurity, because this is what people don't have security anymore, and the stress is really, really painful. And that's what can lead to anxiety, depression, and other mental health problems. And so that obviously has a cost. It has a cost to business.
If I may make a tenuous connection, it's a connection, but somewhat tenuous. We here in the United States of America have had that experiment in the last several years, where we basically bailed out people, COVID, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not making a political statement of any kind. We can devote 7-8 hours to that if you wish. But we have, this government, our governments have doled out trillions to help get over COVID, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what did that do? We did a couple of things. It put food on the table for a lot of people, created some security for them. Two, it had decimated certain industries. No point going back to work because they make more money not working. Standouts are hospitality industries, particularly restaurants. And then, of course, a lot of intense warehouse production sort of stuff where, why do I want to work for that wage when I can earn this? And then, and I will go backwards here. Astounding. June 11, yesterday, 2024, 73% of Americans report that they are struggling to make ends meet in America to pay their bills. Some significant percentage, up in the 70s, of shoppers and supermarkets make choices to buy lesser quality, lesser brands, lesser amounts than they ever have before. 40 some odd, our credit card debt in this country is greater today than has ever been before. 60% of population absolutely lives paycheck to paychecks. They are 2 weeks away from financial insolvency. 2 weeks. There are no savings accounts. And here is the most astounding statistic. In this good Lord's day of June 11, 2024, 25% of Americans report skipping an occasional meal due to the cost. Now, that is laid at the rest. Of course, this is complex. Again, I'm not a microeconomist, certainly, and I'm a casual macroeconomist. It's laid to incomes, not keeping abreast of whatever, all of that. Our employment figures, by the way, are specious. No, we don't have 3% unemployment. It's much greater than that. Add in people who no longer look for work because can't get it. Subtract the people who have two jobs. You don't have 3%. It's much more. But inflation is a result of what? Of guaranteeing income, of supplementing income, which is kind of a baby version of guaranteed base income. And that's the outcome in the United States of America. But to report statistics, and I think they're reliable, that 25% of Americans report skipping meals because of the expense in America. Oh, of course, there's also 1.7 million children that go to bed hungry every day in America. Now, how do you fund guaranteed income? How do you fund it? The governments, this regime and the prior one doled out trillions to help people out, and this is what happened. Oh, by the way, a whole lot of those people did not need it. Did not need it.
Right.
The degree of fraud is mind-boggling. Didn't need it.
Right.
But we did it. Right. And what's the outcome? The outcome is that there are a lot of people then that didn't return to workforce. Why? They made enough money over a year to not work for a year. Mm-hmm. People work the system and there's a lot of money to be gotten. And what happens? Ordinary families make a choice between groceries and petrol, gasoline. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, that's crazy.
The idea there are a couple million children in America that go to bed hungry every day. Mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's
this bonkers. They have
a lot of that as well in the UK. I didn't look into the figures of that, to be honest. But among what's interesting is among supporters who clearly don't understand the byproduct of UBI, 80% agree with the idea of taxing businesses to fund it. 80%, right? The statement that companies benefit from the adoption of AI should pay for a UBI for those displaced by this shift is which I thought was quite interesting.
I think that's hunky dory. I live in the state of California, which is again the fifth largest economy in the world, and it's an absolute disaster for business. Businesses are leaving.
Completely.
Overregulated, overtaxed, incomprehensibly so. If I were to start a business that had any kind of physical presence, staffing, et cetera, I would be in Wyoming. I'd be in Nevada. I would be I'm not going to Texas anymore. I'd be in Tennessee. And I go to South Dakota because the government of South Dakota tells me, come to my state. You're not going to pay taxes for 20 years. You want to build a building? We'll match you dollar for dollar. Why the heck do I want to do something in California? Wow. You know, it's a funny thing. And it's just a little bit of snippet. If you go to U-Haul, you know, the big trailer rental company, and want to rent a trailer. Yeah. And they say, well, what are you going to return it? I'm going to return it in Houston or in Cheyenne, Wyoming, or in Reno, Nevada, or in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's $37 a day. The return fee is X. And bapa. If I'm going to return in California, it's half. Why? Because we rent a million of them going out, and we don't rent any coming back. That's just U-Haul. So if you want to rent one in Texas, they'll give you money to drive it back. That's the state of California. It's kind of like the old Western. Shoot first, ask questions later. Here, tax first, ask questions. So you want to tax my business, all these businesses, to pay for universal wages going for people I don't know. I kind of feel the same way about that as I feel about me. My wife and I paid for our own education. Mm-hmm. We paid tuitions for our children. Thankfully, we're able to do it. I now asked one of my congressmen, do you think I can get my money back? Because there's a couple living across the street, professionals, starting out. They make $247,000 a year. They're getting back tuition money from the government. Why am I paying for that? I already paid for it. So you want to tax me to death to provide universal income, you are tugging at my heart in a very big way and my intellect.
Wow.
I don't want anyone to go hungry. I think it's unconscionable to allow that to happen. But then there are a couple billion people in the world that are hungry. But we have hungry Americans right here in my backyard, you know. Unconscionable. Yeah. On the other hand, you know, I wrote a piece that, thank you, you read, altruism only works if you have profits to support it. If you don't have profits, you don't have altruism. Can't give away if I'm not making it. You want to tax me to death? You want to impose regulations that stifle me? You want to impose taxes that choke me? and don't make any money, I can't give away something I do not have. Mm-hmm. So altruism is wonderful, but there are realities to it.
Yeah.
You know, so universal income, I think it's a panacea. I think it's a dream. I think it's, I don't think it's at least in my mind, economically not sustainable. It's not. Yeah. On a small, small, tiny scale, we tried that here in the United States over COVID, et cetera. We tried it. Mm-hmm. And look what happened. Look what happened.
Yeah.
It sure felt good to get that check.
It's interesting.
How does it feel to go to a market now? Gasoline in Los Angeles is $5.50 a gallon. Wow. In Texas, it's $2.95. But in LA, it's almost $6. People make the change every day. Buy gas, or buy groceries. And that, to some extent, is take universal income to a tiny little level.
But if we step back from all of this and we look at people's jobs and we look at people's skills and we look at the skills gap and then we look at the data that we have on these people, all it really would take is some very smart people at Microsoft or whomever, some company they need to buy, and then they can integrate it into LinkedIn. And everyone can upload their CVs or resumes, if you like, in America. And actually, those people could be told that in 3 years' time, their job is not going to be around anymore. And that actually, if they did some work and they studied at night, like my dad did, you know, I went to college when I was working full time. You studied law as well whilst you were working full time, you know. And you knew that you needed it, right? But the thing is now is that people should be able to answer a series of questions, which might take 10 minutes, upload their CV, and then for some AI to analyze everything, analyze the job trends, use some data crunching, and then come up with a solution for this person or these groups of people. And I tell you what, that is what needs to happen. Instead of LinkedIn and recruiters making a ton of money recruiting people for jobs that they're going to be made redundant from. And actually, they need to use this technology. And in my opinion, we're not far away from having that. But the problem is that all of the AI startups, a lot of them that started out with these big, big ideas, said they were going to do that, said they were going to do this. And actually, they didn't do anything because they ran out of funding. And this has been the biggest problem. We've had an overhyped tech AI bubble. And my personal opinion is things are probably going to get worse before they get better. And in the meantime, I think that we need to really take a look at what we're helping people with, what other skills people have, and how they can actually improve in life, you know. And what can I say, Steve? Is there anything you want to add before I kind of lead out of this? Or,
well, I hope and pray that the world continues to want people like you and I, and pray need, because we talk about this stuff. We try to be, you're a futurist to begin with. We try to be a little forward looking. The idea of this is not to go back and, well, we should not have done that. We should have done that. We deal in reality. We deal in today. People ask us about today. People don't want to know how we got here, which is a challenge for some of us who are natural storytellers. I'm a storyteller. I'm a raconteur. To me, a story has a beginning, a middle, and end. The beginning is historical perspective. People want to know, this is where I'm at. This is where I need to go. This is where I have to go. What I do next. And of course, speaking of self-perpetuation, I hope you and I are never out of work. On account of any piece of technology, there are people out there who are at crossroads in their businesses, interesting enough, in their personal lives, because that all ties together anyway. Where am I going to go? What am I going to do? I'm going to be laid off. I don't have a future. What should I do? Explain this to me. And hopefully, you and I bring value to those people and companies. It's an interesting thing to me, and I don't want to be boastful about this. It's an interesting thing to me sometimes when I get to talk to a board or an executive committee or something in a really meaningful company around the world. And what are the things that preoccupy them? And at some level, and why do they want to talk to me? Hey, I'm an ordinary guy. Well, my perspective, it brings it down to, I don't deal in esoterics. This is what this is about. That's what you and I write and talk about as well. So allow me to pitch here. We do a lot of how-to work. And I certainly do a bunch of stuff. I mean, I can't say it's on the air because it's profane, but I'll clean up. I have a side of my life that's called the oh crap side. That's the 2 o'clock in the morning phone call.
Word. I know you do.
But I was going to use I was going to use the S word because it's more bombastic.
No, you can't use that.
It's the phone call that says something happened to us as a business or us as individuals, and now what? Of course, typically the people who call already know the now what. They just, you know, they know how to swim. Just need somebody to push them in a pool. So I'm the guy gets to say, well, they have a swimming pool. Let's go find one. I'll push you in the water. Now here's how you swim. So that's something that we offer to our audience. And I hope that anybody watching, listening to this, please feel free to take us up on that. It's something that we do kind of 18 hours a day, one way or another.
Yeah. Feel free to reach out to Steve or I. We also create content. Many companies struggle with creating the right content. Recently, I did an interview with Intel, which is very interesting. Wrote a blog around that. Worked with a lot of other tech companies, including Appian, that do low-code, no-code AI and that kind of stuff. And we also understand that companies have a problem with this content and creating it because AI writing tools and different content creation tools have amplified their problem. Enough companies do not differentiate between the utilitarian need for all matter of AI and the window dressing they feel they may have and must have. And what do we provide our clients on top of what Steve has said? Some of that follows. We do content production for forward-thinking brands and ambitious individuals, podcasts, white papers, deep dive industry reports, and explainer videos. Whether it is a white paper, a deep dive industry report, or an explainer video or podcast, Stephen Manning, and me, Nathaniel Schooler, will give you a custom-generated hardcore information and guidance around whatever area you need that help with. And if you have an audience, we will provide you with all you need to tell your story, to captivate and entice your audience, to ensure that they understand who you are, what you do, and why they should pay attention to you. And of course, why they should buy from you. Remember, as Stephen says, this Manningism, nothing happens until you sell something. So if you would like to hear more to the point, no frills and usable implications and reality of AI, Stephen and I are creating industry specific reports and white papers on much of the breadth of the massive AI topic. Of course, the big pink elephant in the room, how AI will affect your job and industry moving forward. And you can contact me on LinkedIn or on info@influentialvisions.com if you would like us to tailor something specifically for you. And we will be creating some show notes which will go with this interview. So thank you once again. Appreciate you joining me, Steve, and appreciate everyone who takes the time out of their day to listen to us joust.
And thank you.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.